Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's January the 29th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, once again this week, I need to kick this off by saying some things to what may now be called our old-time listeners. That is to say, the approximately 4,000 people per week who hit northwestfront.org and listen to Radio Free Northwest directly off the party website. Yes, I know our website gets more hits than that per week, but I kind of have to guess at how many actually download and listen to the podcast. But based on that guess, our new syndication deal with American Nationalist Network, or as it will soon be known, All Nationalist Network, appears to have almost quadrupled our audience, many of whom have never had any exposure to the Northwest Imperative before, and many of whom have no idea at all who I am or what the Northwest Front is. Now, the result is that the next few podcasts are going to have to be very much a case of back to basics, going over all the foundational ideas and dynamics of our movement. And so, once again, I apologize to all you guys out there to whom this is old hat, but it's necessary. Now, this week, I'm going to be reviewing something very basic, the Butler Plan for Northwest Migration. Now, this is the strategy named after the late Pastor Richard Gernt Butler of Hayden Lake, Idaho, the man we consider to be the main spiritual father of the Northwest Independence Movement. Although, of course, there have been others, both before and after Pastor Butler's time, who've advocated a new nation for white people here in the Pacific Northwest. Now, the Butler Plan consists of four broad aspects or phases involving the creation, the build-up, and the operation of the Northwest Front as a political force for white revolution, with each phase containing certain goals or benchmarks that we have to achieve on our way to a new nation. Now, these phases are not nailed to any given time frame so much as they entail a specific kind of activity and an agenda that has to be fulfilled. All four phases will be simultaneously ongoing in the various party units around the homeland, depending on how far developed each local is, and at any given time, the NF will be involved with issues relating to any or all of these phases. There will be a lot of overlap. Now, on this episode of Radio Free Northwest, we're going to talk about Phase 1 of the Butler Plan, and this is the one which we're having the greatest difficulty with now, the relocation of the better elements of the existing racially conscious white community here to the Pacific Northwest. This will be an ongoing project from this point on, and it will continue even after political independence is achieved. 100 years from now, the Northwest Republic will still be seeking white immigrants from what's left of the Western world. It will be the primary function of the homeland to be just that, a homeland and refuge for the persecuted and endangered Aryan peoples of the world, from Afrikaners to Serbs to Ulstermen. Now, the main problem that we have to overcome now is something that I have mentioned in the past, and that's the apparent near total loss of the alpha gene that was once the distinguishing feature of our people. That pioneer willingness and even eagerness to go first. It just seems to be gone. Now, really, you would think that once white people understood what's on offer out here, and once they read the Northwest novels, that they would be on fire with enthusiasm, that they couldn't wait to come out here. I should be seeing out-of-state license plates coming over the hill every day here. But instead, ostensible white nationalists are hunkering down in their houses in their cheap furnished apartments and waiting for Harold to wave his magic wand and create the world that I portray in my novels by magic. They're clinging like grim death to whatever's left of their middle-class lifestyle in nigger-infested Florida and Louisiana, in Mexicanized Texas and Arizona, in Jewified New York and Raleigh, and in the god-awful cesspool that's California. Now, the incredible fact is that rather than bestir themselves with physical effort, most so-called white nationalists would rather stay where they are, in economic misery and physical danger, surrounded by non-whites and liberal garbage and homosexual perverts, cowering amidst the ruins of their old middle-class lives. They'd rather sit tight and wait for someone else to do all the heavy lifting than exert a small amount of effort. than take a modicum of risk and come out here where they have a chance to create a new world. It's really difficult to believe that most white people today are the descendants either of pioneers who loaded up all their possessions onto Conestoga wagons and set off across a trackless wilderness up the Oregon Trail to reach the Northwest with nothing at all waiting for them, or else the descendants of Irish and German and Scandinavian and Italian and Polish immigrants who packed up everything they owned into a few cheap trunks and suitcases and spent weeks at sea in the steerage of rusty old steamers to step ashore at Ellis Island. Again, with nothing waiting for them, no one to set out the cakes and ale. What in God's name has happened to us? What have these damned Jews done to us to make us so weak, so timid, so afraid of our own shadows that we're now terrified to pack a moving van and take a 3 or 4 day drive down an interstate highway, sleeping in a soft motel bed every night, crossing in a matter of days and in comfort a span of territory that it took those Conestoga wagons 9 months to cross, with our ancestors leaving graves behind at almost every stop. The Butler Plan has been in existence since the year 2000. The Northwest novels have been around beginning from 2003. The central idea of Northwest independence has been adequately explained to those in our community, and the complete lack of any realistic alternative plan, or indeed any plan at all, is now crystal clear. So what the hell is everybody waiting for? Basically, they are still waiting for Harold Covington to wave his magic wand, waiting for me to pull the magic beans out of my pockets. They're still watching and waiting for Harold to do it all and produce a finished product that they don't have to help build. They're waiting for Harold and the small handful of people I have here in the homeland to get all the heavy lifting done. They're waiting for the cakes and ale to be set out. Let's be blunt. They are waiting to be given things. Oh, sure, when the word gets out that there's some place white nationalists can go and meet actual real people and not email addresses, then we'll have a flood of newcomers once the dam breaks and they see someone else going first. We just can't find very many people who are willing to go first. Now, I'm not referring to the T-shirt youth, the young men with nothing but the T-shirts on their backs. They're a special case, and I'll discuss them later on, but the fact is that we don't have a bunkhouse or a refrigerator full of beer to offer them, and they're not really part of the equation. Used to be Northwest migration was, hey, let's go up to Hayden Lake and shack up in Pastor Butler's bunkhouse and drink beer. Well, doesn't work like that anymore. Now, I get complaints to the effect of, oh, Harold, I can't come to the Northwest now. There's no safety net. Well, you're right. The lack of a safety net didn't bother our pioneer ancestors who loaded up their Conestoga wagons, and it didn't bother the immigrants who crowded into the holds of those ships headed for Ellis Island. But these are 21st century white people, and they're not made of the old stuff, the right stuff. 21st century whites are products of Anheuser-Busch, the Frito-Lay Corporation, and Mickey D's. No, what we need are substantial white people who have displayed some energy, some talent, some work ethic, and achieved some personal success in life. We need you to come here to bring your skills and your talents and your assets with you and help us build that very safety net so that when this whole American ball of wax comes unglued and we have thousands of white people showing up here in the homeland as genuine, honest-to-God refugees, there will be some way for us to take them in and get them incorporated into the party and into the revolution. Now, I know just before we made this deal with ANN, I was talking about how we may have to reevaluate that and may have to do a little something more for the T-shirt youth. I will get into that again soon. But again, guys, bear in mind our circumstances here. I kind of got off track. Anyway, it's been said that if someone is a success in Florida or Ohio or Texas or Wisconsin, then they're not going to come to the Northwest because they don't need to. Now, this assumes that these are just typical Americans who do nothing unless it's for economic motives or out of self-interest, and that's not the kind of migrants we need here in the homeland. Well, we're not asking people to migrate because there's something in it for them, although in point of fact, there is quite a bit in it for them personally. We are asking them to come home to the land that God and or destiny has appointed to be our people's lifeboat in the storm, because it is right. Now let's consider this a test of character. We need people with that old pioneer spirit who do not come expecting to be given things on their arrival. The American sense of entitlement stops here. We will either recover that old pioneer spirit or else we will perish from the face of the earth. Guys, I'm going to take time out here, and I'm going to tell you a personal story. And this is true. In May of 2002, when I was coming home myself, I was rolling westward down Interstate 80 in Nebraska, and I stopped for lunch at a truck stop somewhere between Hastings and North Platte, if I recall correctly. It was one of these big plaza-type truck stops with a motel and a big restaurant and a little shopping mall. I'm sure you've all seen the kind of place I'm talking about. I bought a local newspaper from Hastings, if I remember right, and I read it while I was eating. Now, there was a story in that paper about a recent historical find in the area. A local utility crew had been digging an underground cable trench or something of the kind, and they'd come upon a grave site with a rough wooden coffin. They called in archaeologists from some Nebraska university to excavate it and identify it. There were some remains in the coffin, presumably skeletal, which they were able to carbon date from around 1850 or so. There were remnants of clothing, what appeared to be a calico and gingham dress. The archaeologists identified the remains as that of a female Caucasian, a teenage girl of about 16. Nothing to identify her beyond that. No way to tell what her name was. Judging from a number of other indicators, they believe that she had been a member of a party of early pioneers who had been crossing the prairie. She had died on the way, and there's no way now to tell how or why at this distance in time. Her family knocked together a makeshift coffin for her from whatever lumber they had to hand, possibly part of their wagon, and they buried her in probably what was her party dress or her Sunday go-to-meeting dress before moving on their way westward, leaving their daughter behind forever, to be remembered only as a name and maybe some old faded 19th century glass plate photograph among her descendants who eventually made it to California or Oregon or Washington. And when I read this newspaper story, I looked all around me at the restaurant and the motel and the little stores full of useless plastic junk and the superhighway outside with the cars and the trucks whizzing by at 65 miles an hour on their way west. And for the first time, I think it really hit me what those pioneers had gone through in order to do what so many of you are too timid and frightened to do. These unknown white people 150 years ago left their home in Pennsylvania or North Carolina or Massachusetts, walking or riding at about 5 miles an hour, most likely to St. Joseph, Missouri, where they spent their life's savings on overpriced supplies, and then they just started walking west. No one waiting for them, no idea where they'd end up, no idea what lay ahead, just following an ancient call of our race that's been with us for 5,000 years, since the first Aryans started walking west towards the setting sun from our first homeland around Lake Baikal in central Russia. The Celts, the Doric Greeks, the Medes, the Scythians, the Goths, the Franks, the Lombards, the Slavs, the Magyars, the Norse. That's how they all got to where they settled and became nations. 5,000 years this little stroll of ours has been going on, and now we're too timid and weak to complete the journey and save our people from extinction. Now, those ancestors of ours set out fully knowing what price they might pay for this new land, and they paid it when they left their daughter or their young wife in that crude box buried beneath the Nebraska sod. But us? Oh, no, we can't come northwest. That's too risky. That's too dangerous. We might not be able to get a minimum wage job in Washington flipping burgers beside Mexicans. Oh, horrors! No, 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 no. Too chancy. Now, what in God's name have these evil Jews done to us? What have we done to ourselves? So let me just tell you this. If and when you finally do screw your courage to the sticking point, as Shakespeare said, and you're on your way out here to your future homeland down Interstate 80 or maybe Interstate 90 if you take a more northerly route, look out your car or truck window at that barren landscape around you as you're going through Nebraska or Colorado or Wyoming, and think about how many other graves like that young girl's are out there, undiscovered and unnamed, along the way that you're traveling at 65 miles an hour. And when you do, all of a sudden, whether or not you can get a job in Seattle or Boise or some town in Oregon won't seem quite so earth-shaking a consideration now, will it? Now, on that true story about the dead pioneer girl, this kind of verges on the supernatural here, but some years ago I heard an old song by the Kingston Trio, which I somehow managed to miss when I heard most of their stuff growing up in the 60s. Now, when I first heard the words of this song sitting here behind this very computer, I tell you guys, the hair stood up on the back of my neck because the similarity to the real-life story I read in that Nebraska newspaper back in '02 is nothing short of eerie. Thank you.
Eyes like the morning star, cheeks like the rose. Laura was a pretty girl, everybody knows.
Weep all ye little rains, well, winds, well. All along, along, along the Colorado Trail, Laura was a laughing girl, joyful in the day. Laura was my darling girl, now she's gone away. Weep all ye little rains, wail winds, wail. All along, along, along the Colorado Trail.
16 years she pleased me, and all her life was good. Now my life has been good.
Weep all ye little rains, well, winds, well. All along, along, along the Colorado Trail. All along, along, along the Colorado Trail.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. This is Andy Donner. Today I'm going to cover Real Politics 4, which is an overview of the subject of race. Quite a few of you might not get a whole lot out of this, since a longtime white racist isn't going to be too surprised at what I've got to say. But it needs to be said. Quite a few different elements in the alternative political scene won't clearly state what they mean when they talk about the problems they want to address. Before I get that far in the Real Politics series, I need to justify where I'm taking the discussion and make sure everyone is ready to go there. Further, all this is fair game for spaced repetition. Race as an abstract subject doesn't come up on this program very much, even if we regularly discuss consequences and tangible realities of race. It's also the case we have folks wandering to and from on the internet who aren't exactly sure what white nationalism actually is. For the record, yes, we do mean race. We're racists. We aren't especially fond of people who aren't white, and we think you should hold the same position. The immediate question is why? Why would we hold this position? Attempting to explain this in detail would take quite literally a lifetime. Good thing it's not necessary. There are a very few high points I need to cover in my general discussion before I move on to a specific issue which tends to elude new and less well-read white nationalists. The first is that behavior, despite all the liberal, progressive, whiny opposition to reality, is genetic in nature. Every single one of us has exhibited odd little incidents within our families where someone mimics some odd mannerism of a relative we've never seen express that mannerism. We don't even know we're doing it until a parent, aunt, or uncle points it out. Further, quite a few studies exist where twins, triplets, and other children of multi-child births are separated and later reunited. This even turned into a daytime television trend for a while. The similarity in life choices, including the ages at which crimes were committed, and even the similarity in the particular crimes, is all quite stunning to someone not expecting it. But so what? Well, as I said, criminality is involved. Criminality, for my purposes today, is defined as behavior contrary to civilization, which is another concept I'll touch on briefly. It's well understood by just about every white person, even lefty assholes, that whites living near niggers don't like niggers. Whites living around mestizos don't like them either. There are a number of Arab hotbeds in traditionally white countries, and they are real hellholes. In fact, there are various sorts of Asians all over the place, and their little communities in large cities are also disasters. What seems to elude us is putting all these things together into a big picture. For some odd reason, the conclusion that white people define what is proper, acceptable, and good is only discussed among very close friends and family behind closed doors. I've had non-racist family members find out my politics and claim they don't agree with me as a prelude for expressing the beliefs I've just named. It's that whole "I'm not racist, but" thing which liberals make fun of normal white people for. Just about every white person has these opinions in one form or another that they won't express until they believe they're in a place safe to do so. Even in that context, some of us have an awful time trying to verbalize what we're thinking. Mr. Covington periodically reminds us of the reason behind his attachment to the novel 1984, and with good reason. This is a perfect example of controlling thought by controlling vocabulary. White people have trouble expressing their opinions because they don't quite know how to do so. It should be completely obvious to all but the most whacked-out, self-hating whites. Race is genetic. If race and behavior are caused by the same thing, then they are intrinsically tied to one another. Those of you in serious disagreement with me or merely curious to learn more about this should reference a book titled Race, Evolution, and Behavior by Philippe Rushton. This is the definitive scientific work on the subject, and I couldn't recommend it more. Following that, material concerning the social impact and problems racially mixed societies deal with can be found in two books by Carlton Putnam, Race and Reason, and the follow-up, Race and Reality. The two Putnam titles have very excellent point-counterpoint material to handle objections to pro-white racism. When you get done with all that, it's best to proceed to understanding what sorts of consequences for civilization race entails. For that, I recommend Lothrop Stoddard's The Revolt Against Civilization, The Menace of the Underman. Stoddard does a great job of documenting the strain on a society which is plagued by the problems racial heterogeneity invariably causes. From there, proceed on to a textbook by Arthur Kemp, titled March of the Titans. Kemp's history of the white race very carefully and thoroughly demonstrates, through verifiable evidence, should any of you still be interested in arguing, that the world's great civilizations were the product of higher quality white peoples, and were only destroyed when they allowed themselves to come into regular contact with and be overrun by non-white peoples. The takeaway here is that the world we all know and love will very easily disappear should white people not retain their own territory and defensive capabilities to ensure they may raise future generations free from the problems modern white men and women are all too familiar with. But am I going too far with this? Could there possibly be some good non-whites? Well, it's actually not relevant. It's just like the reality that there will always be some unsavory whites running around. Those few degenerates in the white race don't keep society from operating. On the flip side, even if there are good non-whites, they clearly don't have any effect on the fact that their racial brethren are incredibly dangerous to be around. Should these mythical beings exist, they have no bearing on anything whatsoever. But really, am I taking this too far? Can non-white hordes really overwhelm our societies to the point where they break? Well, yes, demonstrably so, considering I can quote history textbooks to prove my point. But the real trouble is that it's happening again. Most normal white people come further and further right, to the point of being near racists, when they take stock of the ills currently plaguing us. The magazine Mother Jones recently ran an online article explaining why politics might be hardwired into people's brains based on genetics that give them a behavioral predisposition to one thing over another. But do politics really fall along racial lines? As it turns out, they do. After the 2010 midterm elections, a shifty diversity education contractor for the federal government named Tim Wise wrote an open letter to white people. He claims it is only to the white right, but as I'm about to demonstrate, he really did mean all white people. The letter was quite long, so I'm going to cite the portions relevant to my point. Quote, "Your time is limited. Real damned limited. And you will lose. This isn't hubris. It isn't ideology. It is not wishful thinking. It is math. In 40 years or so, there won't be any more white folks around who think the 1950s were the good old days, because we'll be able to teach about them accurately and honestly. In about 40 years, half the country will be black or brown, and there is nothing you can do about it. Like I said, this is math, and numbers don't lie. End quote. That wasn't too pleasant, was it? As I said, I cut quite a lot of the letter, but I didn't alter its meaning one bit. It's on the man's website, and anyone can verify what I pulled from it with very little effort. Incidentally, anyone who wants to can verify any of the things I've said today with very little effort. Anyhow, Mr. Wise claims he's speaking to right-wing white people only. But is that really the case? If ideology were the issue here and not race, then why would half the country being non-white be a problem for the right? And further, what is Mr. Wise under the impression current and future generations will be taught? I've gone through enough material to make it very simple for anyone to learn the truth about race in history. Race is real, and it matters. Tim Wise knows this. Everyone who isn't a complete buffoon knows this. Most importantly, Wise's remarks in his letter show he knows ideology, as reported on by the aforementioned Mother Jones piece, is just as genetic and therefore racial as anything else. When he says white right, he really means white. Non-whites universally lean left, and normal white people, even those in larger cities, contrary to popular opinion, tend toward the right, though they would rather not admit it. Further, Wise very carefully calculated his words, and he understands that white people are going away as a whole, not just particular ideas, though they're almost the same thing. We are being overwhelmed just as our ancient civilizations were ages ago. But why is Tim Wise, who claims to be white, so excited about this? Well, you'll note I used the word claims. He's anything but white. And with that, I've arrived at the more delicate of my points I mentioned when I started introducing my subject. There are some more important nuances to the subject of race which sometimes confuse new white nationalists. I understand some longer-term white nationalists, who are otherwise squared away, aren't up to snuff on this next point. Before we begin, I'm going on the record as saying that I personally consider this a severe failure on their part. If you will recall the stages of learning concept I introduced some weeks back, a long-time white nationalist should have reached the level of unconscious competence on the material I'm talking about today. But quite a few haven't, despite the amount of time and effort they've put into the subject. It's no one's fault but theirs, either. So, if Tim Wise isn't white, then what is he? Let's consider that his name could also be pronounced Weiss. What sort of name is that? It's Jewish. Tim Wise is a kike. As an aside, for just a second, Jews are quite good at changing their names to hide, and there are plenty of historic periods where they've done so. Kikes aren't white, and this, provided someone understands race as well as they should, is almost trivial to demonstrate, which I will do now. As has been pointed out, behavior is associated with race, not religion. Jews are notorious for behaving the same way throughout all of history, which has resulted in their being kicked out of all manner of countries hundreds of times, especially by whites. Religions change over time, even if many would like to pretend they don't. In some cases, such as Spain, conversion to Christianity was an option which permitted remaining in the country, but that didn't make Jews any less kikish than they were before. Racial behavior is an invariant over time. One cannot tell a Buddhist, Catholic, Protestant, atheist, or pagan from one another by lining them up. One can, with a certain amount of knowledge and a little bit of intuition, tell a Jew by their appearance. I'm told that New Yorkers can spot a Heeb from a mile away due to the amount of exposure they have to New York kikes. In fact, I had the severe displeasure of knowing a couple of Messianic Jews some years ago, and they were just as obnoxious and horrible to be around as any other Jew. They were literally the stereotype of a sheeny and were just as anti-white as their racial brother Tim Wise. Religion doesn't constitute Judaism. Race does. Religious Jews and atheist Jews think of each other as totally Jewish. This couldn't be the case if Judaism weren't a race. Since I've referenced materials which contain hard racial science, I'll point out that nearly all of world Jewry, even the whitish-looking ones, have blood protein which tests in the Asiatic variety. This proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that a Jew cannot be white any more than a nigger, spick, or other shit-colored hominid. The Northwest Front recognizes this in its draft constitution. Section 1 establishes the standard of nationhood and citizenship in the proposed Northwest American Republic. Article 5 reads, quote, The race commonly known as Jews are in culture and historic tradition an Asiatic people and shall not be considered white or accorded white racial status under law. No Jew shall be allowed to enter or reside in the Northwest American Republic under any circumstances. End quote. This is the sum of the party's commentary on the matter, and anyone not in compliance with this position cannot be said to be of the same mind as the Northwest Front. Having said that, there's a matter I must address. On Radio Free Northwest, and on his personal weblog, Mr. Covington has repeatedly quoted the late Pastor Bob Miles on the subject of Judaism and Jewish ancestry. On the surface, Pastor Miles appears to completely contradict every sane white nationalist's understanding of the Jewish question. What he said, specifically, is that Judaism is a state of mind, and that, quote, Jews aren't a race, some of the worst Jews you will ever meet won't have a drop of Hebrew blood in their veins. Obviously, that's not literally true. Further, my understanding is that Pastor Miles subscribed to Christian identity and could not in any way believe that to be literally accurate. I figured I better cover this to prevent a litany of questions from people who remember official party sources as having repeated the remark Miles made many years ago. Truth be told, Pastor Miles was definitely on to something, but it's complex. Whenever someone says something which cannot be literally true, it's best to try to imagine what they're actually getting at before writing them off. Mr. Covington captured this best on his personal Thought Crime blog when he expounded on Miles. Judaism, or at least the Judaism in view, is the rejection of man as a spiritual being and the reduction of life to purely material terms. Both communism and capitalism, being economic expressions of what happens when racial Jews run society, are totally materialistic. A better way of thinking of the concept is to realize Pastor Miles was talking about what happens when an otherwise decent white person becomes the Jewish equivalent of a Uyghur. A white kike. A wike, perhaps? Regardless of the terms we use, the phenomenon should never be used to invalidate the fact that Jews, whatever else they may be, are a race. I've gone way too long today, but it needed to be done. Using race as a gauge allows us to talk about not only the problem of white genocide, but also to examine various ideologies and possible solutions in terms of their impact on race, and therefore, on white genocide. Hail victory, comrades.
I mentioned last week that one of the kinds of music that I most like to play on this show is music by white nationalist musicians. A lot of course, is skinhead rock, but a lot of our people seem to be branching into folk or quasi-folk or easy listening or whatever. I am not sure who this group is. I think Andy sent it to me, but with my usual senile memory loss problems, I have forgotten who did it or where he got it. Anyway, it's called The Goys of Summer.
You own everything. You even write out laws. Took the flow of money with your greedy claws. Oy vey, must be nice to be so comfortable. Beating off the rest of us, parasitic fucking slow-mo. Mr. Goldstein, you scheming, thieving scum. You got your sideburns down and your yarmulke on, baby. I wonder how it must have felt when driven out of every land that you coveted with cold green eyes, strangled with your scaly hands, victimized, justified, merchant is your friend. This every fool believes and gets a backstab in the end. Mr. Goldstein, rubbing your hands with the light, you try to make me feel guilty cause I'm a white. I must now call on the help of Ben Garrison after the Goys. was right, you can never look back. I didn't understand till I took the red pill. Now I can see all you fucking vampiric shills. Mr. Goldstein, you scheming, thieving scum. You got your sideburns down and your yarmulke on, baby. How many times will you cry six gorillions after the joys of summer have gone? Mr. Goldstein, rubbing your hands with the light. You try to make me feel guilty cause I'm a wife.
Last week, I played part one of Edgar J. Steele's long 2008 podcast on the subject of anti-Semitism and the Jewish question. Now, this is part two.
The trigger event serves as a sort of personalized wake-up call. Once awake, the evidence of what is being done to America and the world becomes apparent. None so blind as though who will not see and all that. And that evidence is everywhere. Supposedly, Jews account for 2.5% of the American population. Why, then, is half the student body at Harvard and almost every Ivy League college Jewish? Statistics simply are not kept as to the percentage of Jews in this profession or that, but when was the last time you saw a doctor whose name did not end in Berg, Mann, or Stein? I'm not sure I've ever met a psychiatrist who wasn't Jewish. On the other hand, have you ever seen a Jewish farmer or mechanic? Rarely do I appear in court, but what the guy on the other side of the courtroom, and often as not the judge too, is Jewish. And it's incredible the deference paid by the bench to the Jewish DA or whoever sitting at the other counsel table. There has been more than one trial where I could have merely phoned in my participation for all the good that it mattered that I was even there. So many complain about what bankers, especially the international and central bankers, are doing to our country. Yet, hardly anybody seems to have noticed that those people are almost exclusively Jewish. They are everywhere in the media, particularly Hollywood. Talking heads, movie stars, and the like. Curly hair, hook nose, and names that rhyme. Pay attention, you'll be amazed. The names won't always be a good guideline, however, given how many changed their names at the turn of last century, so as to meld into the American population of that time. Jews seem to comprise about 50% of America's population based upon those in visible positions. Looks can be deceiving, though, because like Harvard, they are drawn to those positions by their money, their intelligence, and most importantly, the indulgence of their kosher comrades. People refuse to notice the Jewish hands on virtually every power lever in the U.S. federal government, or at the helm of virtually every media organization that exists, and throughout the executive and editorial rank. And it's not just Jews that control America, they are Zionists. Even Ariel Sharon, Israel's prime minister, has said openly, "Every time we do something, you tell me America will do this and will do that. I want to tell you something very clear. Don't worry about American pressure on Israel. We, the Jewish people, control America, and the Americans know it." He said this to his cabinet on October 3, 2001. The problem is, most of Americans seem not to know it. Books have been written on the subject, but essentially a group of late 19th century elites comprised of Rockefeller, Morgan, and others, mostly Jewish, established an organization designed to consolidate their control of America, and eventually the entire world. It was called the Council on Foreign Relations, or the CFR. Offshoots, such as the Bilderbergers, have formed since then, but the objective has never slipped from their sight. One of the first acts of CFR's members was to survey the newspaper field, the sole mass media of the time, and conclude that purchasing control of only 25 major newspapers would give them effective control of news dissemination. They went out and bought those papers, and since then, many, many more. Today, members of these shadowy organizations literally run virtually all of the media, control the political structure in America, much of world business, and are firmly in control of world banking. That is why the two political parties in America have become identical, so as to provide us rubes with the illusion of throwing the rascals out come election time, yet with the same old agenda, not missing a beat. Did you really see a difference from Bush to Clinton to Bush? They knew what NAFTA would do to America's manufacturing base and job structure, yet both parties embraced it. We're firmly on a path to one world government, America writ large. But the America now being molded without individual civil right, not the America of the 20th century, and it's largely kosher. Read an article entitled, The Israeli Spy Ring Scandal. Check the online version of today's talk for a link to that article on the World Wide Web. It provides a particularly chilling look into the extent of the Israeli spy ring recently uncovered in America and Israel's extensive U.S. telephone network ownership. It is not the purpose of today's essay to prove Jewish control of America. There is ample material available on the internet for those who wish to prove it for themselves. Rather, it is my purpose to show that there are perfectly valid and understandable, even laudable, reasons for being anti-Semitic, resenting those who manipulate us on a daily basis against our own best interests is primary among them. 2.5% Jews versus 70% Caucasian, used to be 95% not too long ago. Yet they set the agenda domestically and internationally. Why else do you think we are even in the Middle East? The oil is the excuse that allows us cynically to stop and look no deeper. Notice the extreme difference between U.S. policy in the Middle East versus elsewhere, exemplified by the fact that we are invading and destroying Iraq, a country with nothing, while we give a pass to North Korea, a country which just threatened to nuke America. And it's not enough that Zionists control America. They have to reshape it to suit themselves. Virtually every recent case that involves the removal of Christian symbols from society is brought and or prosecuted by a Jew, usually with a Jewish judge presiding. For the sake of the feelings of 2.5%, all the rest of us must yield our cultural heritage, removing Under God from the Pledge of Allegiance, taking down plaques of the Ten Commandments, removing crosses from public venues, erecting menorahs in public venues, taking Christ out of Christmas first, then Christmas out of the year-end holidays altogether. Hate laws are a singularly Jewish invention being foisted upon an unsuspecting public, so as to preemptively remove the possibility of criticism of themselves. Often written by the ADL, the organization that lobbies for their adoption state by state, the laws are designed to stifle dissent and speaking out. Even now, the ADL seeks to broaden their sweep to include Holocaust revisionism, as has occurred in Canada and most of Europe, where many people sit in jail for publicly stating true facts about the so-called Holocaust that Jews simply do not want publicized. America's borders are kept wide open to a flood of illegal immigrants purposely, apparently to dilute the population. Why else? Thereby making us much more easily controlled. Yet there is a furious struggle to expel those who criticize Jews, such as is taking place with Ernst Zundel. Contrast this policy imposed upon America with the extremely closed society of Israel, which is reserved solely for Jews. The money that Israel has cost America, facilitated by their Jewish brethren, is nothing short of breathtaking. For a particularly good discussion of those costs, I would encourage you to see an article entitled Costs of U.S. Middle East Policy and Economic Overview by Dr. Thomas R. Stauffer, but it appears that the web now has been entirely purged of that article. Even so, I give you a link in today's online version of this essay, which directs you to another's essay which parallels Dr. Stauffer's work and, in fact, reproduces a good amount of his work. Here are a couple of particularly salient paragraphs from Dr. Stauffer's article. policy in the Middle East has been very costly to the U.S., as well as to the rest of the world. The cost to the U.S. of its policies in the region has accumulated to over $2.5 trillion, an amount greater than the cost of the Vietnam War. About two-thirds of those costs, in the area of $1.6 trillion, arose from the U.S. defense of Israel since 1973. Since 1973, however, protection of Israel and subsidies to countries such as Egypt and Jordan, willing to sign peace treaties with Israel, has been the prime driver of U.S. outlays or the trigger for crisis costs. $2.5 trillion. Boggles the mind, doesn't it? Let's see now. America has a population of 290 million and about 80 million households, so that amounts to $31,250 from your family to Israel. And that doesn't include some other items, which could easily double that figure, as demonstrated by Dr. Stauffer as he continues. Quote, rescue of Israel in 1973 by President Nixon cost the U.S. almost $900 billion in lost GDP, resulting from the Arab oil embargo and higher oil import costs. Worsening political relations resulted in the loss of hundreds of thousands of U.S. jobs. Hundreds of billions additionally were spent on Project Independence, ostensibly to emancipate the U.S. from reliance upon Middle Eastern oil. The projects were largely co-opted by domestic lobbies of diverse colorations, and little imported oil was actually displaced. Close quote. What's ironic, if not pathetic, is that an incredible amount of our own tax dollars given to Israel come back in the form of campaign contributions to American politicians, funneled through American Jewish hands and foundations, making Israeli and Jewish interests the single largest lobby in Washington, D.C. Any politician who dares to vote or speak against Zionist interests faces a withering campaign at election time, ultimately funded by this country's own taxpayers in the main. Now you see why Sharon's statement about controlling the U.S. is true, quite aside from the considerable direct control exercised by American Jews. Zionists will do anything to advance their own interests. The 1967 extended attempt to sink the USS Liberty in international waters off the coast of Gaza, for example, killing 37 U.S. sailors and injuring another 174. Now, it's unclear whether the Israelis were attempting to eliminate witnesses to atrocities they were committing during the Six Days War, or attempting to create their own Reichstag event by blaming Egypt for sinking the Liberty with all hands. False flag operations are particularly favorite Israeli ploys, however, so as to curry support. There are far too many problems with the official 9/11 story, too. The only real question that remains is whether the U.S. or Israel was really behind it. John Kaminsky sums up a number of them eloquently in an article entitled Billions Are Wondering Why. Again, a link to that article is in the online version of today's talk. John says, quote, few people are raising questions about the obviously false statements we have been told about 9/11. Why did it take 28 minutes for flight controllers to notify NORAD two planes had been hijacked when the average time to do so in such a case is 3 minutes? Why were fighters scrambled from a base 180 miles away when seven other bases had fighter jets ready that could have done the job in a fraction of the time? Why was FEMA in New York the night before the crashes? Why did those fires at the base of the towers burn for 100 days? Why did Bush read a book for a half hour when he knew two planes had hit and two more were hijacked? Why was the Bin Laden family flown out of the country when all flights were grounded? Why did the FBI chief say we had no warning this was coming, and everybody else in the FBI say we had plenty of warning? Who did make the billions of dollars from all those put options on two airlines the day before the attacks? These are only a fraction of the questions the government continues to cover up, as several billions of people know. Close quote. Now, even Mr. Kaminsky stayed away from the obvious Jewish involvement, however, you notice. not a mention of the Israeli art students caught celebrating on a rooftop nearby while they photographed the ghastly spectacle, nor of all the missing Israeli executives and workers that day, people who otherwise would have died in the World Trade Center, nor of the two-hour advance warning provided to the employees at Odigo in the building. Odigo is a Jewish telephone firm. Nor of many other indicators of Israeli involvement. Now note, John no longer avoids naming the Jew since he wrote this article, having since undergone some extensive mistreatment by them. In fact, John has become one of the more outspoken critics of things Jewish recently on the web, which is why, I suppose, his website, www.johnkaminsky.com, once again is offline just now. In particular, hardly anybody wants to discuss who benefited from 9/11. The Afghanis? Yeah, right. Al-Qaeda? Not a chance. Iraq? Sure. What country was plummeting in the world's opinion? Especially America's. At the time, what country whose fortunes in that regard turned around 180 degrees overnight? Israel, of course. And we haven't even discussed what Israel has done to the hapless Palestinians or what they're about to do, just as soon as we're distracted by Baghdad 2. As if the provisions of Patriot Acts 1 and 2, whereby Americans can be jailed without hearings, stripped of their citizenship, and deported for further processing, aren't enough. Recently, Israeli hit squads were given the go-ahead to roam the entire world, including America, all the better to protect Israel's interests. Yes, there are an abundance of reasons to be offended by Israelis, Zionists, and even the Jews who provide cover for their brethren. Most people deny the existence of most of those reasons and ignore the rest, until they suffer their own trigger event, that is. Every time I talk about Zionists, or Jews, or Israel, I come under an incredible insult on my website and my email servers, some from Lebanon, where Israel maintains internet servers, and even more from American Jews. False claims to my ISPs in an attempt to get me shut up. And viruses. Well, you wouldn't believe how many. And hate speech. You haven't even seen hate speech until you've seen what righteously indignant Jews can deliver. If you could just see what will be happening on my computer in the coming week, that alone likely would make you a believer. But it's important that these things be said. Out loud, too, not in whispers. People have to wake up. It's almost too late. You see, they're on the verge of adapting the hate crime laws to outlaw such discussions altogether. Finally, I simply cannot let you go without adding my own little twist on the age-old Jewish wail about anti-Semitism being a disease. Yes, I agree that anti-Semitism is a disease. You catch it from Jews. New America, an idea whose time has come. Thanks for listening. Please visit my website, www.conspiracypenpal.com, for other messages, just like this one.
Recently, a good comrade of ours up here in the homeland was suffering from a long and annoying illness, and while he was recovering, he reread my novel, The Brigade, which is probably the book that I will be remembered for, insofar as I'm remembered for anything at all. Anyway, he sent in this musical selection and said that he found it a very suitable theme song to the book. This is Max Resist.
I never really known any Jews or niggers before. I don't like hurting people.
Oh, I don't either. I don't even like seeing a fight. But if we don't fight back, they'll take it all away from us, the whole country. Jew boy judges and bankers and politicians with the nigger police and Orientals.
All these people with guns, Shorty.
Yeah, I know it. I don't like it either. Hell, I have to close my eyes every time I pull the trigger.
Right. We're running long, and since I'm trying to keep the show down to an hour more or less, I have to wind this up, which I'll do with a housekeeping note. Now, we got a really good response from many of our new listeners at American Nationalist Network last week, but there's something I want to mention. Now, many of you went to our party website and tried to contact us through there, and I think I got most of them, but sometimes, for whatever reason, that function on the website doesn't seem to work. I don't know why. We do get a lot of spam off the site, including some bot in Asia Minor someplace that fills up the mailbox with pure gibberish, and it could be somebody's spam catcher intercepts some legitimate contact attempts. I got an email today from a man here in Seattle who mentioned that it was the third time he'd emailed me and I hadn't responded. This was not just me letting someone slide through the cracks. I honestly didn't remember the guy, and I don't think I'm getting quite so senile that I would forget to save a contact and then forget about it altogether. So it's best, I think, if new people just email me directly at nwnet@earthlink.net. That's N-W-N-E-T at earthlink.net. You will get back an auto response from my own spam catcher asking that you formally request to be added to my list of approved recipients, and you need to return that. And then we'll get you fixed up with an intro pack. This is that famous, ruthless Nazi efficiency you've heard so much about that once made us the terror of the civilized world. But for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Adaban. Freedom.
Well, they fought for poor old Ireland, Uncle Bitter was their